that he gets pretty much puffed up over the whole thing. He finds a way to be important. And there is nothing that is more quick to gain attention than a good hysteria. So the individual frequently finds for the first time in his life that he becomes important. And this is not a good discovery. Because an individual who is important simply because he is a nuisance is not gaining the proper relationship with life. Where is the problem actually to be faced? Is it possible for us to so polish and cleanse this internal coordinator that it becomes pristine, pure, and incapable of further error? Can we fumigate it? Can we do something with it to get rid of the unfortunate situation that exists there? I doubt it very much if this is the approach, and I believe this is the difference between Buddhistic psychology and Western psychology. Buddhistic psychology says that you can't do it this way, that the cause of the whole situation is the intensity of the sensory perception to the acceptance of phenomena, that the correction has to be made in connection with the intake of material, that the individual can only finally put his life in order when he provides through the sensory perception a reasonable and factual group of evidences, and only when the mental coordinator is relieved of the pressures contributed by the constant supporting of previous opinions. So that actually, if we're going to get rid of this deluge that is accumulating and rising like Noah's oblivion within ourselves, we must turn off the water. And in this case, the flood originates in this tremendous openness to an infinite diversity of meaningful and meaningless phenomena. The individual has no power of discrimination. He accepts usually that phenomena which creates the greatest intensity of reaction. Quality is not the consideration. He hears the loud noise much better than he hears the soft sound. He hears the loud dust spot much louder than he hears the quiet sage. Everything is in terms of the quantity of impact, the broad general acceptance of ideas, and very little is concerned with their quality, their value, or their integrity. So the individual has a self now that is pretty much a tyrant, that is in a sense befuddled. That if this self is to a measure also bewitched by the conditions under which it exists, it can be so confused and so completely disoriented that it collapses in mental illness. But all it really is an overburdened mental interpreter. It is a comparatively low level of employee who is given the job of handling the whole business, which he cannot do, and then is constantly pestered by suggestions, advice, criticism, and opinion by other people. Under such condition, even an able mind is not able to function properly. The self being, in a sense, therefore, the product of all this process. The Eastern philosopher prefers to think of this sensory self as the victim of sensory pressure, brought into existence by the infinite and infinitely complicated chemistry of sensory testimony, mental interpretation, conduct moved by this interpretation, which sets up new situations in society, which again are picked up by the sensory perceptions, taken back and reinterpreted. Around this cycle, again and again and again. which is almost like the mysterious wheel of the law, which goes around and around while individuals cling desperately to the spokes of their own opinions. Breakthrough this sensory self-process, then, the first step, according to Eastern philosophy, is to realize that it isn't very important. That what we think about things, not very important. But whether we ever gratify certain pressures in our own nature is not important. What we feel about this and that is not important. Because actually, the only person that can have important ideas is a person who has a better than average integration of all these factors. For the most part, therefore, we are punishing ourselves, whipping ourselves, in a desperate effort to prove something we cannot prove, and that is that we are always right. This is the hardest thing in the world to prove, and many individuals have battered themselves into oblivion trying to do it. The relaxation of this pressure into the Eastern way of thinking is simply this detachment process. The process of the individual releasing the power of his own attitudes by gradually lowering the vitality or libido which he expends on the assimilation of phenomena. Suppose we have here five sensory perceptions, which are carrying tremendously intense records. A tremendous amount of energy is being used to convey messages along these sensory channels. These messages are a wild diversity of things, all of which, by the way, pertain to the outside anyway. We can examine the outside to the end of time and we'll never solve the mystery of the inside, but that doesn't concern us. We are constantly taking in more and more of all these things we hear about, read about, and which we observe and see and taste and feel in the physical sensory perception range. If, for example, this is all carried on a kind of an electric circuit, a certain energy carrying these messages continuously, the intensity of the messages, the continuous transmission of them, depends upon this energy. If you reduce the energy, if you turn off the current, so that these messages are no longer conveyed from the environment to the mental coordinator, then the environment factually ceases to exist, because it has no existence apart from sensory perception within that area. When we close the eyes, the visible universe vanishes. If we stop up the ears, the auditory universe vanishes. If we stop up the nose or get a good head cold, then the sense of smell ceases to function, and the olfactory processes are no more. If by some way or condition the sense of taste is destroyed, then flavors are no longer sensed. And paralysis can make it impossible to have any physical sensation of contact with another object. Thus, through the sensory perceptions alone, man is bound to the universe of phenomena, which is his principal seat of activity and thought. Though it would also follow naturally that the individual could, through unconsciousness, through sleep and death, also achieve the break between the mental coordinator and the phenomenal world of the physical existence. But philosophy is not concerned primarily with this break. It is not concerned with cutting off and destroying all contacts. Such concern might be present in certain advanced cases of mysticism, where the individual is completely determined to transcend all physical conditions. But for the average person who needs help because of pressures, because of difficulties, the important thing is to lower the rate of intensity of these reactions. The individual, by giving less energy to the sensory processes, will reduce the amount of phenomena which they carry to the mental coordinator. This permits the mental coordinator to slow down. It also permits the entire process to be subject to another faculty of the coordinator, which is usually not applied at all, and that is thoughtfulness. Thoughtfulness requires a certain interval, a certain leisure, a certain power to contemplate events or conditions or facts with a kind of leisure. Now, if these facts tumble in too great a confusion, too rapidly and too intensely, thoughtfulness is, well, not only difficult, but usually impossible. So the problem comes of slowing this entire machinery down until it becomes controllable and directable. It is necessary to slow the traffic on this psychic freeway before everyone trying to drive the freeway is killed. And these freeways or channels of communication between phenomena and the phenomenal interpreting center in man must be clarified, simplified, made orderly and direct. And the person who wishes to have greater clarity in any area must simplify. Clarity is not the result of constant struggle. Clarity is the result of releasing the consciousness from the most dominant of those pressures which deny or make clarity impossible. To do this, in the Eastern philosophy, the individual is taught certain meditative disciplines, the tendency of them being to bring internal reaction, not to paralyze the sensory perception, but to direct it, to condition it, so that its testimonies will be more comfortable, more pleasant, and more meaningful. That gradually these sensory perceptions are trained away from recording that which is worthless, recording that which is essentially untrue. Also, having reduced pressure, the mental coordinator can achieve that which is its peculiar symbol in the level of mentality, and that is righteous thinking. A state of righteousness, or of being right. This rightness is the basis of true virtue, and therefore righteousness is rightness in the estimation of value, about which we hear a little, but do not see or experience too much in daily life. As this process of sensory reaction is slowed down, we then learn another lesson. We learn that the affairs of the outer life do not plunge through the subconscious into this mysterious, intangible core that we have mentioned in the beginning. In other words, the subconscious is not an open road into the eternal being behind man. This eternal being is non-operative as far as objectivity is concerned, for that the cycle of awareness does not penetrate beyond this mental coordinator, which is therefore properly to be described as the ego or the sattva or the self. The substance of all this conglomerate process together is the activity which we consider very often, even spiritual, but which really is spiritual only in the peculiar definition of being vital, that it has vitality in it. It is not spiritual in the sense of having any virtue in it, any particular real or essential meaning. It is animate, but not truly living, because it is a series of intensities which are constantly pushing each other and themselves, moved on by the mysterious power of the human will. The sensory gamut, or the sensory perception, might well be likened, therefore, to gates leading in to the subconscious. They are also the same gates which, in another way, have to be used to reduce the internal pressure. Like the sacred bridge, traffic moves both ways. And on this problem, there should be this constant release or relief of that which is accumulated inside as pressure. Now, pressure can be released if it is constructive. And the pressure, if it is no more constructive than steam, can drive a steam engine. But the average person, psychologically speaking, discovers that almost any release of pressure results in detriment. He finds that his pressures are sickly. He finds that when he permits them to break through, they damage him. They damage his outer life. But this can only mean that they are already damaging his inner life. So the release of these pressures through the outer life as a primary means of clarification is merely to throw confusion from the subjective to the objective. Though we may say this helps. It might help if the process could be paused to terminate there. If we could accept this subconscious pressure into the consciousness, rationalize it, organize it, survive it, and finally cast it away as our necessary refuge, if we could free the body of it, as we might free the body of toxins by catharsis, we might be all right. But the unfortunate problem is that as we are working with this load, a new load is developing. The very processes of eliminating set up situations which create a new load. The individual trying to extrovert some frustration breaks the law and goes to jail. A new group of pressures set in, moving back into a psychic integration with all the discontent and unadjustment of what he may well consider to be an unjust sentence. Everything continues to build up pressure. The only point in your Oriental philosophy where this pressure can stop is when we no longer feed it. We must get at its fuel source. We must get at the cause of the pressure itself. And the cause of the pressure is the continuous acceptance into an organism of certain dangerous stimuli from the outside. This, then, is the beginning of your concept of mysticism, both in the East and in the West. We have in Christian mysticism the great sense of asceticism, which has been as strong in the West as it has been in Asia. We have the individual who renounces the world, who enters holy orders, who gives up all worldliness, who goes away into the mountains to become a hermit, who renounces most of the pleasures and wealth and advantages of life. He turns from fortune to the black robe and goes alone into the wilderness, perhaps, or to become a servant of those in need or suffering. Humility, self-abnegation. The individual gradually bringing his own nature into harmony with a contrition of spirit in which he accepts himself suddenly as being a very humble person, as being someone who must seek spiritual strength who must turn to God and not his own opinion or security, and who can only find truth by the continual systematic renunciation of error. So we have it as the same principle in both the East and West. We have the individual sensing that the tremendous attachments of his consciousness to worldliness are the cause of his difficulty. So in the West, we also live in another century. We live in a time when nearly all asceticism is reserved for very small groups of persons who have tremendous determination to advance some form of religious life. For the rest, asceticism does not seem to be very practical. It does not seem that we can survive, maintain the responsibilities with which we are duly burdened, and at the same time try to escape life, to escape living, or at least that phase of living which we associate with material existence. So almost all of these systems, whether of the East or West, have to be adapted. They have to be made available to the Western person in a form which he can take some advantage of, without completely disorienting his way of life. Now, there is no actual answer to this that is complete. For obviously, a partial attachment is going to reduce the pressure, but not eliminate it entirely. The individual who makes a 10% adjustment will get a 10% result. There's no way in which a person can remain partly worldly and partly unworldly and have a completely unworldly release from worldliness. This is simply not possible. But fortunately, to the thinking of modern man, we are not at the moment outright perfectionists. We are not demanding absolute happiness. We are not demanding absolute peace or absolute freedom from worldliness. What we are really seeking, at first, at least, in our proceeding, is to bring the situation into a tolerable state. We want to have a measure of security. We want to have a certain sense of integration. We want to be able to make important decisions more wisely than we make them now. We want to be as good as we can be. But we are not at all certain at the moment that we could be absolutely good, even if the opportunity offered itself. There are too many complications lying between. So instead of saying to the individual, leave the world, cause the end entirely of this fueling of the set of the machine of the six senses. Provide it no gasoline, provide it no oil, provide it no compressed air, provide it nothing, so that the machine simply ceases to function. If it ceases to function, the mental coordinator ceases to function. And in the end, you have the parinirvana, or the complete extinction of the objective being. But instead of saying that, we take a different attitude. We say that it is perfectly conceivable that between a miserable state of subjective existence, such as we know now, and the ultimate in which we have no existence, there is the possibility of a middle ground. And that middle ground is to have a comfortable, pleasant, happy, and well-adjusted subconscious. It can still exist, but it doesn't need to be the endless botheration that it is to most folks. We might not say, I'm ready to dispose of both my outer and my inner life. But we might be able to say, I will make certain corrections of my outer conduct if it will give me an endurable, happy, and normal inner life. If I can enjoy a good subconscious, I will accept that at the moment as being enough. And this, of course, is exactly how the great concept of Mahayana Buddhism came into existence. because the paradise of Amitabha, suspended between the outer illusion and the absolute perfection, is this paradisical sphere of the individual with the happy subconscious. The happy subconscious being equivalent to Dante's Paradiso, which is suspended between heaven and hell. The person who has a happy, comfortable, internal life may have considerable desire to enjoy it, may feel that he has a right to be the person he would like to be, that he can do gracious things, that he can have beautiful thoughts. If he reaches nirvana, it may not be possible for him to listen any longer to some of the very fine Bach compositions. And he's very fond of Bach, and he likes a little occasional diversion in Beethoven. If he goes into absolute Mahaparinirvana, he will not enjoy the beauty of the sunset anymore. He will not have the pleasure of gathering with his friends, the old Chinese sages in the bamboo grove, and writing good poetry for the common amazement of each other. There are a lot of pleasant things. He will not hear the laughter of children anymore if he retires forever into the foreverness of things. So that is not either particular with Western man, and increasingly so with Eastern man, as he begins to take on more and more Western conditions, and where the idea of comfort and success becomes strong status symbols. The point is no longer to the average person the complete rejection of the sensory machine and its functions. What is rather now sought is to feed this machine a kind of fuel which will enable it to pass through its processes in a quiet, orderly manner without tormenting the mental coordinator, and will allow this coordinator in turn to put together the lovely and charming elements of a beautiful mosaic so that the final picture is delightful, constructive, useful, and inspiring. This is what the average person, I think in both the East and West, would want for today. This does not deny that he may have the sight, the sense, or the value that the beautiful mosaic, like the great palaces and temples of the past, will ultimately crumble, that all conditioned existence must actually and finally be unsatisfactory. This he may admit, but he still feels, and probably rightly, that for him the growth from the conditions that he knows to some state utterly beyond his comprehension is a slow and arduous one. And it is easier for him to go by single steps than to plunge into a situation for which he has no real aptitude. So we begin the work on the diet of the coordinator. We do not start essentially by fumigating the subconscious. We start by conditioning what we will permit to go into it. Here we take an objective stand based not necessarily always upon our own judgment, because our own judgment is arising from this coordinator and may not be sound. But we are also subject to the tremendous traditional pressure of ideals. In this same world that is giving us so many difficulties, there are also great structures of high and noble aspirations. Just as surely as we are confronted agelessly with the selfishness of man, so we are also confronted through time with the lofty unselfishness of man. We begin to see and realize what constitute the great lives, what constitute the real, essential, illumined purposes of dedicated human beings. And we are able, gradually, through the sensory perception, becoming responsive to these things, to develop a certain attitude of determination by which we begin to censor this process. Now, how we censor it is not the subject of this evening's talk, but we will come to that also. The principal purpose of the moment is that it is censored. And by degrees, we censor what goes in. And that which goes in must become the basis of that which is inside. It must be the food of the subconscious structure. So we try, little by little, to visualize, to experience, to become continuously aware of those qualities around us which we would like to have on the inside. And this brings us to the next step, of course, which in the Eastern philosophy is the use of the mandala. In the Western philosophy of psychology, the mandala is usually the drawing of an aberrated person, by means of which we attempt to estimate the nature of the aberration. In other words, the mandala is a projection from the person and must therefore represent one of two things, either the state of his aberration or the basic understatement or archetypal statement of his own revulsion against this aberration, both of which represent the two poles of the mental coordinator, struggling between the positive and negative experiences with which it is constantly being deluged. Thus, the theory of it is, in the West, that the mandala is a revelation by means of which the individual is releasing diagnostically, auto-diagnostically, the situation in which he is in. That this, therefore, is much the spirit of Western art. Much Western art in the last 25 years is frankly psychotic. There is no other possible explanation, and this is not said in the sense of a facetious remark. These people are sick. They are sick as we are all sick. The only thing is, some of us can't draw. Therefore, we cannot make pictures of this sickness. Some of us simply howl in the night, that's all. Some of us walk the floor. Some of us hate each other. Some compose strange and inharmonious musical compositions. And some paint morbid and psychotic pictures. But all these things are the tale of suffering. They are the evidence of a great disorder within the psychic integration. So it's one thing to assume that this release is of value. I've always questioned it. I think these mandalas of these psychic drawings should be made at a certain stage. They do help in some conditions, particularly in advanced psychiatry, where it is actually necessary to get every fragment of available information concerning the aberration of the patient. But that these things should be hung in galleries for the edification of people, or that they should be placed over the mantle in someone's home, is like placing there a particularly choice fragment of dissection or something of that nature and considering it artistic. The real problem is these are clinical things. And as clinical things, they're valuable. As art, they are not valuable. If, however, we use the Eastern concept, it is not a problem of the individual drawing his aberration in two dimensions. The problem is that the individual should be confronted with a design or a pattern that, moving in upon his subjective, will do something to normalize it. The therapy lies, therefore, in the authenticity of the painting which is being contemplated. If this painting was contrived or conceived under inspiration, by an individual in a very advanced state of mystical insight, if it was achieved through the internal experiencing of certain values which transcend both the subconscious and the conscious minds, this painting then becomes archetypal in a constructive sense. It is no longer the painting of a sickness. Even if the artist was not completely illumined, It is certainly the picture of an aspiration. It is the picture of a motion toward betterness. It is a picture of appreciation, of realization, of the tremendous veneration for principles perceived and sensed. It is a story of universal unfoldment captured in a truly consecrated human soul. This type of picture, which is the Eastern mandala theme, has been very carefully guarded in most of the Oriental sects where such paintings are produced. There are seldom any variations of any kind permitted from the original designs. These pictures have been copied 500 times, and not the slightest individuality can be detected. The later artists were avowedly and obviously copyists. They could not have devised the original design, but they preserved it. They preserved it for the benefit of those who came after, who would find in these designs a meditation, a conditioning phenomenon, which could go into the consciousness and begin the process of therapy on the inside. Here is the mandala as environmental material transmitted by the sensory perception to the coordinator. But now these perceptions are carrying a valid testimony of value. The coordinator receiving this valid testimony is naturally going to react to it validly. At first, perhaps, with not much insight. At first, perhaps, with prejudice. But gradually, over a period of time, if the pressures of the non-valid testimonies are reduced and the unchanging pattern of validity remains, gradually the subjective becomes permeated with this archetypal form of harmony, beauty, order, symmetry, and the tremendous pressures also, tremendous intense psychic pressures of the patterns of principles and laws which are revealed through the design. The design is lawful. It is like Bailey's Signatura Rerum, the seal of reality that is stamped upon the human heart. This seal of reality comes into the same sensory perception. But instead of leading to the pandemonium that we know now, the mandala ultimately causes the arising within the subconscious of the great mandala concept of the paradise of Amitabha. Here, then, order inside begins to take over. This order taking over, it gradually creates its own constructive influences. These influences censor just as the wrong ones did, the coordinator in estimating the reaction to sensory perception. And little by little, the individual begins to see and experience the validity of good. He begins to see the law operating around him, whereas previously he saw only disorder. Little by little, he is able to discriminate between various levels of sensory function, and he becomes more and more aware of the eternal presence of that which is essentially true, thus quieting down, releasing, and he finds greater tendency to use these perceptions to increase beauty, wisdom, and insight within himself. He turns to the arts not for a livelihood, but because they give warmth and peace to his soul. He begins to appreciate things that once he thought were foolish, because suddenly simple, gentle, kindly things have great meaning. Little by little, this results in a relaxing, a letting down of the unreasonable and false pressures. The nature still lives in this world. It still functions here. It still does its daily work here, just as it always did. But it is in this world, but not of it. It continues to meet every responsibility, but it cannot be hurt by the illusion of worldliness. Because in order to be hurt, there must be this self, this ego, that is always right and must therefore always suffer from the actions of others. The moment this ego principle relaxes, the moment we have no longer the great determination to be right or wrong, as soon as we have no vice to defend and no virtue to defend, we simply relax. And in the relaxation, we become right. We take away the pressures, and normalcy is that which remains when pressure is gone. In all these mystical systems, good is not something to be cultivated as a separate thing. You cannot water it and fertilize it and expect it to bear fruit. Good is normalcy. It is the reasonable. It is the right. It is the thing as it must be and as it should be and as it really is. Therefore, you do not create good. No one can. No one can declare that there is more good in existence because he has done something. Good is that which is ever there, but is obscured by that which is not good. If, therefore, the individual ceases to do that which is not good, he is good. And in ceasing to do that which is not good, he does not become negative. He is not inactive. He simply must realize that good is not the opposite of evil. That good is that which eternally exists and which is obscured by pressure. As we relax pressure, as we cease to be ourselves, we are good. And in the larger mystical sense of the thing, when we totally cease to be ourselves, we are God. The difference lies in this matter of estimating how we shall attain the end. We become God-like by attaining that state in which we are no longer like that which is not God or is not good in its final sense. There is a little fable about it which is rather trite but still has a bearing. Diogenes said that the man who has least, as far as these worldly things are concerned, is most like God, inasmuch as God, as far as we can know, depends upon nothing that man can confer or anyone else can confer. Therefore, the individual who has the least and gives the most is most godlike. There's also deity.